You're listening to UnConcast on the Georgia Podcast Network, featuring unconference sessions and other related discussions from around the Southeast.
In this episode, Christopher Claus gives a keynote presentation titled Trends That Will Change Your Profession and Life at SoCon 07, an unconference which took place February 10, 2007 at Kennesaw State University.
Good morning, guys. Morning. Just checking to see if everybody's awake this morning. I appreciate you guys coming out and listening and having this discussion today. I think it's important for all of us. And wanted to talk about what I think are some of the trends. I guess I'm the so-called expert to get up, and Sherry asked me to spend a little bit on what's going on in this industry, in the media, the social media, and what are we doing, and you know, what are some of the how's it going to affect your profession, how's it going to affect your life? Ultimately, I do think this has a huge impact on everybody, and that's why I'm pursuing this today, is to talk about. You know, ultimately, I think these technologies do enable us to connect in new ways that, you know, have never been possible before. So I'm going to go at a high level. I'm going to try and keep the presentation as minimal as possible, but I think there's some important facts in the presentation. And if someone has questions, feel free to raise your hand during the presentation, but I want to save a lot of time for the end for questions, answers, dialogue, conversation. And so on. And at a high level, I'm just going to hit on three major points. Evolution of media, where is it going? What I was asked to talk about today was really hit on some of the trends that's happening out there. Also want to just cover some of the virtual world stuff. A lot of you guys have seen articles about it, but there's some numbers and data behind it to talk about what's happening there. And then what's all this mean? What's the implication of the social media, the virtual world, and what are the future trends in the industry? At a high level, you know, when I started the Kineva, the company that I'm working on, you know, we were kind of at the Web 2.0 model. This was three years ago. And you're starting to see that, you know, broadcast TV has moved from, you know, content is controlled and scheduled, you know, with TiVo and Slingbox and all these new technologies out there. The content itself is now being controlled by the viewer or the person, the consumer at the end of the day. Technology, you know, it's still, for the most part, most people, the majority of people have their set-top box that's connected to their TV, and it's still a very closed system. Meaning the only feeds that you're getting to your TV are typically the cable or satellite provider. And I think even within those channels, there's about 1,000 channels, probably less than that if you look at cable and satellite, but that's going to explode. And then, so one of the things I was looking at is based on these trend lines, you know, what's media 3.0? And I think one of the points made here was, you know, we're getting, as the media is, you know, more encompassing of our life, one of the things that's starting to happen is how do you get to people when you got a message? And I think we've heard the issue. I got so many blog feeds, so much information coming at me. And if you're a business, you know, you're trying to run a business and you say, I got a great product, how do I tell people? What's been interesting is the number of ads that are out there. A lot of people think, oh, just put a big ad out there. Well, there's so many ads that we don't realize. We don't see what may be important to me. The relevancy may not be important to me. And so from that, we're just getting an explosion of ads. So how do businesses bypass some of that? And ultimately, you know, just like for the same reason we're all here, it was really around word of mouth, whether it's someone we knew, like Sherry, who emailed us and said, hey, here's this conference unconference that we're going to pull together. And, you know, it's word of mouth spread. If I thought, hey, this is interesting, and it might not be for me, I might know somebody else that would be interested in this, or, hey, let's get a group of people to come here. And ultimately, there's been some cool technology out there. There's a technology called I-beam. Anybody seen I-beam before? No? Okay. Well, they did a tracking study where they tagged the email with a ticket system, and basically, the I-beam is just a graphical representation, and you can track how quickly word of mouth spreads. And it was amazing, like, you could quickly find the connectors in a crowd. I don't know how many people here read Tipping Point. Anybody here read Tipping Point? Okay, great. Everybody read that then. If you haven't read it, read it. It's a great book on, you know, mavens and subject matter experts and how they influence our culture and society. But you can, you know, what's neat about where the internet's going is it's enabling us to actually measure word of mouth. Before, you know, there's no way to tag real dialogue in the physical world. And now as we're starting to all talk through our cell phones, our email, our social networks, et cetera, it becomes a whole lot easier to see how quickly the influence of just a small handful of people then spreads to thousands or millions of people around the world. And I think what we're seeing also at a high level is just, you know, there's four major types that you can communicate. You know, there's many to many, which is what we're here all today for, is how do we all talk together and socialize. The historical communication model, like radio, like TV, like newspapers, which are more of a one-to-many model, they're all on the downcline, especially in the younger generations, where the viewership of newspaper readers is declining in the traditional sense, and more people are getting their news online and getting their news from the blogs and connecting to other people. The area that's growing the most is really many-to-many. And that's if you're on all these different social networks, and blogs is a social network in of itself. And that most people might think, you know, a blog is one to many, but anybody who's really in the what they call blogosphere, realize it's really a conversation. You can't, if you're trying to run your business as a blog and you think it's just a one to many communication model, it's probably not going to be as effective as versus if you change the model to say this is really that you're part of a conversation and you're dialoguing with others, and as you dialogue with others, you become part of a much bigger thing. And that's what makes the many-to-many model so powerful, because your thoughts and your discussion gets amplified across lots of bloggers, lots of people talking about the issues that are important. So some of the attributes at a high level of many-to-many media. I think, you know, number one, it's about socializing. It's about communicating with others, finding people, reading their profiles, sending messages. It's about connecting. At the end of the day, it's one of the most important aspects of being human is socializing and being with others and finding people who have shared interests and passions. You know, as you get into not just socializing and communicating, you want to share those experiences that you have passions around. And that's being done today. More and more people are, you know, uploading their photos, uploading videos, sharing their music. And I think one of the areas that's missing, you know, for most people is the virtual world aspect, which takes it to a whole new level, because it's a real-time interaction with others with a human element, because you look like a human instead of just a text. It's bringing us to a new level. And I think also there was some discussion about how do we, you know, the search engine, how do I find what's relevant to me? I think ultimately it's going to be found through some kind of collective intelligence, this personalized search, you know, what I'm interested in. You know, statistically, if I'm in the group, I think there's some math models out there that are emerging where, you know, just like Google has changed how search works in a general basis, I think there's a lot of evolution or innovation to be done in the area of how do we search based on my preferences and rather than the preferences of the entire internet. And ultimately, you know, I think we're going to see more and more models emerging that allow communities and people within those communities to make money online so that it's not just a hobby. And I think what, you know, a lot of bloggers have moved from, hey, this was fun and I'm communicating, to where many of them have quit their jobs and have pursued a life in blogging, as well as all other forms of this media, I think, is emerging. And I think traditional media is starting to realize that and look at it and say, how do I tap into this online community? How do I generate revenue? That's actually a big question that's going on with the movie industry, with the newspaper industry, and so on. So it's a big issue for anybody who's been in that business. How do we support our lifestyle through that? One of the conclusions I came to with the social media or media 3.0 was the next generation of media is all going to be about word of mouth, connecting producers, community owners, participants. Ultimately, the open media set-top box, I think the device that you hook up to your TV has traditionally been a box that is passive. You know, other than switch from channel to channel to channel, and then you find what you're interested in. And to some extent, it's a very non-interactive community that you're finding. If you go to the History Channel, there's probably thousands or tens of thousands of other people watching that channel simultaneously with you, but there's no mechanism that says, hey, why not bring all these people together and have a dialogue and have a conversation? So one of the things is that's kind of interesting is as these boxes become more interactive, and have you all seen, anybody here have Xbox 360? A couple people? All right. So one of the things that if you look at, most people think of the Xbox 360 as purely it's a video game machine. But if you, I've got a friend who set it up, and he said, man, I connected it to my TV, and somehow it connected to the rest of my network, and now I can play all my movies, all my photos, everything onto the TV. And they've announced a deal, I think, with AT&T to start rolling out that Xbox device as a set-top box. And so we're going to start seeing, I think, the traditional devices that are connected to TV to be more interactive, to be more, not just flipping from channel to channel as we've known it for the last 20 years, 30 years, we're going to start seeing it really become a more interactive device out there. And I think that's going to be, we're already starting to see that happening with TiVo. TiVo's downloading videos now off the internet. Almost iTunes is with the iMovie and the iMac device. They're trying to move towards basically embedding the computer into your TV. I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to be about having all the intelligence that you have sitting at your laptop or at your desktop will now be built into your TV. It might be a different controller, but by and large, you're going to want to connect to others through your TV set in the future. I think the other thing that's starting to happen is the mobile devices are all becoming part of, I think of my cell phone as my laptop. Unfortunately, the only thing that's preventing me from not using this is the output device. I can't hook it up to the projector. But otherwise, it's got PowerPoint, it's got everything I need to connect, and it's got a keyboard and everything else. So, I mean, over time, I think where we're going to see social media, it's going to be with you everywhere you're going. And I think what's exciting is we're starting to see some of the functionality that's emerging with even the cell phones is, you know, you're going to see a lot of geo-tracking capabilities starting to emerge. I'm aware of this one company that's got this GPS technology for your cell phone, and they're beta testing it at colleges. I wish I had it when I was in school, because one of the things it does is, you know, at the last minute, it can detect, if the local pizza shop has some leftover pizzas, it can announce, hey, we got a pizza sale, and anybody within that radius gets that alert and can run there and get free pizza. But what's exciting about it is now also the cell phone is hooked up to the security. It provides protection for, you know, if somebody's walking late at night, gets hassled, or someone tries to rob you or whatever, you can hit a button on that, and the GPS location of that person immediately goes to the campus police, and they show up, you know, 5 minutes later or 2 minutes later to find out what was happening. And so all that is starting to come together, and I think it has, you know, some security value. It has obviously marketing value. And I think ultimately we're going to start to see video games or interactive and applications take advantage of all that, and it'll be emerging for, you know, lots of opportunity to connect people in ways that we've never thought about before. Also, I think ultimately as the content is now being delivered over the internet, and you're going to see this more and more so, it's going to be infinite number of channels. As many channels as you want to create, you can create your own personal channels, you can create a channel for your family, create a channel for your friends. And I think it really ultimately is going to democratize how media gets pushed out there in terms of connecting with others and what kind of media is available. And everybody here is familiar with the long tail. Everybody knows long tail, yes? Okay, great. But it's all about a lot of the niches that are out there and finding those niches that you have a passion about. I'm just going to spend a little bit of time talking about virtual worlds, because this is a new area, unless you've been playing video games for a while. But it's a pretty new area for a lot of people. A lot of people don't realize how big the video gaming industry is, and virtual worlds is a bigger umbrella of video games, but I think video games have driven the technology to where what's enabling virtual worlds. Last year it was over $10 billion, and this is just for the North American market. I want to say it was like 20 or 30 billion worldwide for video games. How many people play video games here? It should be about half, so. Might be higher in this group, though. 50% of all Americans play video games, and it was interesting. 3 years ago, when I was getting into this, you know, I started talking to a couple CEOs I know, and about half of them were like, "Hey, I play, you know, Battlefield or some game late at night," but they never tell anybody. So it was kind of shocking to find out how many people do this. And then as I was getting into the MMO space, or the massively multiplayer online world, it was pretty interesting, because actually there was a friend of mine, her brother's like a CFO at a large public company, and he was setting up his pager or his alarm clock to go off at like 3 a.m. because he was part of a guild and they were doing a raid on a castle, and you know, she's telling me the story, and like, you know, you just don't hear about this, but it's happening all the time. You know, people are really connecting into these worlds. The other probably myth that's out there, a lot of people have a perception that games are for little kids, and you know, I think kids are definitely a big adopter of video games. Any kid I know plays Nintendo DS or any number of other online games out there, but. The reality is the average age of video gaming players is about 30, 31 years old, which is pretty surprising to a lot of people. And more and more, this percentage, the 43% of gameplay is happening online, that is increasing every year. And in fact, I think it's going to increase dramatically. If you think about the Xbox, I don't know if you've heard, you know, one of the big factors of Xbox was that they did Xbox Live. One of the things that really saved the Xbox, I don't know if anybody followed this, but they made it easy to buy casual downloads of casual games. And, like, none of the games were ready when they launched the Xbox. And so the number one games were all these casual games from their Xbox Live arcade, like Geometry Wars. I don't know if you all saw the stats on this, but the thing that saved Xbox 360 to have some momentum was the fact that they actually were connected online and people could download games. Because a lot of the big games that they had talked about weren't ready when it came out. And even today, most of the downloads or most of the activity that's happening has been through online activity. Anybody play World of Warcraft? couple people, all right. Two people in here. Well, there's about 8 million people playing it worldwide. It is the largest, what they call MMORPG, massively multiplayer role-playing game out there. Just last month, the Burning Crusades came out, and within 24 hours, sold 2.4 million copies, which is almost $100 million of, and this is an expansion pack for this game. And you know, most movies never come close to this. And this is, and what's amazing about this is it's been out for, I think, 2 years now, and every month people are paying $15 a month to play this game. And when you add up all the number of people that play it, et cetera, it's close to $1 billion of revenue on a subscription basis. Plus, these expansion packs don't help, or they do help. And from that, it's a huge change. In fact, South Park did a whole episode on it. I don't know if you all saw that one, but it was hilarious. If you haven't seen it, you need to find a copy of that one. But there's what's also interesting. Up until this month, gold from that world, which you're already paying $15 a month, people were spending close to $1 million on eBay alone for the gold. Now eBay just came out and said we're not going to do any more virtual items for video games, and that one of the main contentions was World of Warcraft actually doesn't want you buying the gold off of eBay or any other site. They want you to be playing the game. In fact, there's a whole industry that's emerged. I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but there's these groups called Chinese Farmer. Anybody heard of them? All right. Well, there's a handful of people know they're out there, but they're in these games, and mostly it's from people from China, because you can't understand what they're typing if you try to talk to them. And all they do is they don't really play the game. They're working the game. They're in there. They're farming. And what they'll do is they'll find like a dragon and just sit there and kill that dragon over and over, because when you kill the dragon, you get a special sword. Well, because they're killing that dragon, nobody else can get the sword, which makes it less fun for actual players. This is why Blizzard, the company that makes WoW, doesn't like it. But that group takes those special swords and then sells them on eBay. There's also a company called IGE. If you go to IGE.com, it's pretty amazing because, you know, most of their transactions are in the hundreds of dollars. You can go on there. Characters are up to $2,000. Gold, you know, price range, nothing less than $10. So you think about, you know, buying virtual goods. It's a pretty amazing economy that's emerging around that. So some of the, just at a high level, you know, I think the trend for gaming technology, is going to go from, you know, one-to-one to one to against each other up to a million. You know, it's now, what's changing is you're no longer just playing by yourself. You're playing with millions of people around the world. And I think that's going to continue to be a growing spot in the, both in the gaming industry, and what I'll get into later is this technology, I look at it from purely a technology basis, can be totally repurposed for so many other needs. So it's not just video games. So let's, you know, a lot of people think, oh, it's just gaming, it doesn't affect me. But ultimately, this technology has a lot of other applications. And I'll just, at a high level, some of the biggest ones out there, World of Warcraft, this is old data on the 5 million, but NCSoft is the largest Korean company in doing video games. I want to say like 70% of the population is in the some of their games. Like the penetration level per capita is in South Korea is much greater than in the U.S., where people are playing games on a constant basis. And I think a lot of it has to do with the density. They have been, they have higher speeds only because they have, you know, really one big city, Seoul, and so it's very much easier for them to connect to everybody to fiber and get gigabit to your apartment, et cetera, versus in the U.S., we're so spread out, it's a lot more expensive to do that. The good thing is with wireless and other technologies coming out, I think we're going to catch up. But on a social, cultural basis, a lot of them, a lot of the Asian countries have been in what they call PC bongs, and it's not relating to drugs, but it's related to getting together in a basically it's a computer cafe where there's 20, 30 computers, but all these people get together and socialize and join clans and join groups and play these games all the time. And I think the other thing, if you've picked up a newspaper in the last 6 months, Second Life has gotten a lot of awareness out there. And this is one of these totally user-generated worlds where anybody can go in there, and if you got 3D modeling skills, you can build out whatever you want. I don't know. Anybody here have 3D modeling skills? A couple people. So you can go in there, build castles, spaceships, all that stuff. So it's an interesting world. I think it's fun in the sense that, if you're designing stuff, you can really show off a lot of capabilities there. Ultimately, I kind of see social media, that what we've talked about earlier, is going to get combined with virtual worlds. And so, if socializing was a big part of social media, doing it in a 3D environment adds a whole new level of human element. You're jumping, you're dancing, you're high-fiving. That's a lot more exciting than just getting an email from somebody. It changes the activity level. The other thing is, the experience level, I think it's exciting to watch videos together or watch a movie together with your friends and family. Open up the photo album book and remember that, and all that. So that's great. But also, I think new experiences can be created with this technology like we've never experienced before. And that's going on new adventures, go in the mountain areas, experience fantasy realms that you can never experience before. If you're in the Lord of the Rings, there's a Lord of the Rings game coming out this year that is a massively multiplayer game, and it has all the lore. So you can live out your fantasy of actually being there, and it feels like you're really there. And ultimately, I do think it's important to share your videos, share your photos, and that's going to be important to bring that into the virtual world as well so that you can connect to others and watch movies together and connect in that regard. Collective intelligence, I think there's a lot of opportunity there. I threw in one thing. Just if you're a World of Warcraft gamer, there's a website called ThoughtBot. And it was pretty innovative, whoever came up with it, because what they did was, it doesn't require a lot of gamers, but a handful of gamers, and you run a little agent, and what this agent does is it collects all the data from that world as you go on quests and missions and goals, and you're collecting special weapons and fighting monsters. All that data collectively gets automatically populated into ThoughtBot. And now almost anybody who's playing World of Warcraft, if you haven't used ThoughtBot, most of them are that I've talked to. And what it does is it gives you all the clues of how to navigate the world and what you're going to need to do to get past certain quests. And ultimately, there's a lot of different business models within the whole virtual world. And just at a high level, what's kind of interesting is in a modern day world, you can bring in real brands, real advertising opportunities. I think what we're going to see is in the social media, if it's great content, you can offer subscriptions. One of the trends that's really big though is I think I'm going to be surprised in 5 years from now that if most of these games don't start trending towards what I would call item-based economy. And this is instead of selling you a subscription, like World of Warcraft, it's $15 a month, and that's all you pay. What I think is going to be the next big trend is item-based economies, where you can buy stuff from that world that's for real money, and that's how you make the revenue on the back end to run the servers and all that. And you're already seeing, I think in Second Life, they sell their islands for like $20,000, $25,000. Habbo Hotel, anybody heard of Habbo Hotel? A couple people. It's a kids game, but they were on track to do over $100 million worth of virtual items. I'll show you a picture of that. Real quick. A lot of people don't realize how much time is spent. You know, you hear about the Nielsen ratings for TV, where less and less people are spending time watching TV. Where are they going? I have sort of a clue. They're spending 17 hours in this one game alone, where the average play time is 17 hours a week. How many times have you done any kind of other media where you haven't played, where you played 17 hours? That's a lot of hours. That's the average, right? And then there's research coming out from CMU saying people that are in these virtual worlds, this goes beyond just the video game, that it becomes really part of their life, and that the people they interact with inside this world, actually they start to interact with outside the world as well, meaning that they're communicating, scheduling, small talk. They really build a relationship with these people. It's not just a fun experience. It has real meaning to it. Virtual world activities, there's tons of stuff to do, but big things are socializing, casual gaming, exploring, gifts, etc. How about hotel? This is again for kids, but what they do is you can log in for free if you want to check this world out. It's not really exciting. In fact, we had some Georgia Tech interns, and we said, hey, analyze this game, and they said, the most exciting thing is to go up to someone and type fight or punch, I think it was, and then the person back could say punch, punch. And because there's no way to actually do that, you know, but it was kind of interesting. But people, you know, buy stuff for their apartment or their room and invite friends over, and it's kind of interesting. They're all socializing and connecting. And I think there's a ton of games that are emerging in this space. If there's one area that's blowing up in terms of excitement that you really don't ever hear about, anybody heard of Club Penguin? If you have kids, you might have heard of it, or know people who have kids. Club Penguin, there's like these little sites, and you think, oh, it's a flash game, and at the end of the day, you start playing it, or your kid's playing it, and it ends up costing $5 a month. Oh, what's $5? You know, it's a Big Mac at Burger King or McDonald's. And next thing you know, they've got like 10 million users, and you start adding up the numbers, you know, 50 million a month. It becomes a real business model, right? And so those flash games that are really, and what's exciting is, it's not true for all games. You go out there, most games, like when I got into this industry, most game studios were saying, man, we're struggling. You know, the publishers totally take advantage of you. And, you know, from that, you don't get much royalty, et cetera. The exciting thing that's really happening, if you don't come from the traditional video game industry, you can actually, what's happening is a lot of these people are building games going direct to the consumer, going direct to us, everybody in here, and they're selling their games directly, and the games that are taken off is all around the social media, all about connecting kids to other kids, and like Club Penguin, you get to be a penguin. Penguins are hot this year, and within the penguin, you get to go into an igloo and learn dances and share your dances with other penguins. The reason we're all here is to talk about how we can socialize, and our kids are doing it on a daily basis. It's changing how they interact. Cyworld, this is another South Korean company, $140 million in sales last year. Again, 70% of it was in virtual items, and 30% paid to upgrade their photos. I mean, there's a 300,000 virtual items every day. And again, this is kind of a 2D flash world, but it's pretty amazing that people can get immersed in these environments. In our own backyard, we're talking about in Georgia, you know, what opportunities are happening in Georgia. It's been pretty interesting. Coca-Cola worked with a local design studio and designed out Coke Studios. Again, they've had 8 million registered users log in there, and they have a large number of concurrent users on any day in this virtual world, and it's been their number one marketing program in the last couple of years, So if you're thinking about, hey, what's this mean for my business? It's pretty amazing that, you know, one of our companies in the backyard has pioneered this, because they did this like 2 or 3 years ago, maybe even longer. And their Coke Rewards, you guys heard of Coke Rewards, and basically they have this whole loyalty program. Well, one of the things that's exciting for them is some of their number one transactions for their, you know, people redeeming their points, their rewards, is these virtual items, which don't cost a lot to make if you're an engineer. You can kind of calculate the electricity bill, which is probably becoming the biggest cost in these worlds. What's interesting is that the number one thing that people were buying were empty pizza boxes to put in their room. Who knows why, but for kids, it was the coolest thing to have an empty pizza box to come on over, check out my empty pizza box. So future trends, just at a high level, I think what we're starting to see is people, you know, large companies like IBM, has, you know, the CEO of IBM has said, look, this is one of our top initiatives that we want to explore. And it's not because we want to get into the video game industry. It's because this technology can be repurposed and used for other things than video games. Obviously, the internal e-commerce for virtual items is very real. The opportunity to take that and make it immersive, bring a human element to it, means you can now start to bring e-commerce for external or, you know, physical items in the real world. And in fact, I think there's a huge affinity between what you see in your apartment. You buy certain furniture, you buy certain fashion, you're going to end up wearing that fashion in the real world or buying that stuff for your real house. And in fact, I think in the future, you know, more and more decorators should use a platform like this to say, hey, here's what your house is going to look like when I'm done with it. Because I went through the process, hired a decorator to rearrange the whole house, and you're like, oh, we're never going to get this back together. And in a virtual world, you know, a decorator could go in there and really design it out and say, here's what you like. Oh, no, I don't like that style. Tweak this, tweak that. Next thing you know, it's a much faster process to visualize how you're going to live on a personal basis. And it could also be applied for businesses in that sense. And I think the paradigm shift that a lot of people haven't yet quite fully connected to this is, ultimately, as this technology becomes, I guess, genericized so that and easier to use, all businesses today, I think, are moving, you know, I wouldn't say all, but a lot of them have moved towards a web-based front end somewhere, right? Most companies have some kind of web presence. And I think in the future, as this technology starts to get packaged up and repurposed and simplified, you could have a whole 3D element to your business where people are walking into that. And that's where this internet 3D thing really connects, is that what the web did for allowing companies to present themselves in a brochure type of feel, where, hey, here's what my company's about, here's my product, services, about the team that's behind the company. I mean, almost all websites have the same core elements of what is that brochure when you go there. I think the neat thing is, you know, in the discussion here today is about, you know, dialogue and connecting, and I think more companies need to have dialogue with their customers, with their user groups, and I think this is the real opportunity within this space, is that what the virtual world can help amplify is that there's a human element there. We're all humans, we're all connecting, and within that have some kind of 3D representation of that company. I mean, the most cutting edge companies out there that are leading the charge in this space realize it's not just about selling your product, it's about creating an experience. And if you look at Starbucks, you know, there's a certain feel, a certain ambiance to every Starbucks you go into. There's a certain familiar feel. You know, if you go into Nike Town, you know, Nike spent a lot of money to make Nike Town, and it wasn't, you know, it was the whole point of it was to create a different experience. And it's not just we're here to sell you shoes. It's about a brand, about about an experience. And that's where, you know, not most companies can't afford to build like a Nike town. So why not create a virtual experience that embraces what you think would best represent both your company and how you want to interact with people. And some of the early adopters already are like Circuit City. They're going to build a virtual store. Ultimately, to be, you know, I believe people will go into these virtual worlds, check out the items. Today, I think the interface is very clunky to integrate with this. But over time, I mean, we're just at the beginning of this. Over time, as this becomes as easy to navigate as your web browser, I think it'll be very easy to go into a store and pull up pictures and rotate the objects. If you're a car enthusiast, you can check out the next model, go inside of the car, drive it around, get a feel for it in online.
Chris?
Sure.
Got it.
You're bringing up a lot of these companies that are going into the virtual worlds to promote their brand identity and all that other stuff. Doesn't that kind of fly in the face of what's happening today, which is that the companies are having a much harder time controlling their brand, and that the harder they try to hold on to it, the less they end up having? Because the harder they try, it just seems, you know, the harder they try to control the brand and promote their image and stuff like that, it just seems to me it's not working. It's not the same world anymore. It's not a one-way conversation.
That's right.
And that going in there and trying to promote what they do in the offline world just seems like to me that it's not getting feedback from the customers and using that to help grow their business. It's more like, this is what you're going to buy, damn it. So.
Sure. Well, I think what we're seeing is an evolution of how businesses are perceiving this. Meaning, I think the initial companies that say, okay, I want to control, like the old model was definitely a one-to-many approach to talking to customers, right? And so in that model, there was a lot more control, right? You can sit there and you can say, exactly, here's how we're going to wordsmith this press release. We're going to get it out there. And, you know, if somebody puts up a website that bashes us, we'll try to sue them. We'll try to bribe them to take it down. Whatever we have to do to try and control our brand.
The less control they really have, because you have the tidal wave of people that are pushing back against that.
Right, and I guess it's a paradigm shift, right? I think a lot of companies are realizing they can't control what's being said about them, but what I'm thinking most companies are going to have to do in the future is realize there's this big shift, whatever you want to call it, social media, that we're connecting, we're not being spoon-fed, you know, the messages and the marketing and the entertainment anymore. So from that, I think the most likely option in the companies that I think are going to be on the cutting edge here will be to embrace those communities, start to bring it, and it's a new thing. So very few companies have successfully done it. But a good example was when Microsoft hired, was it Robert Scoble? And he was a human interface into that company. And he shared kind of, here's what's happening at Microsoft. Oops, we made a mistake. I'm talking to the group. They're working hard to fix it. And ultimately, I think that paid off tremendously for Microsoft. I think they need to, he's obviously left and they need to replace that. But from that, they need more, and it's, you'll actually see more and more companies are embracing it. Even though Robert was kind of the spokesperson from a blogger's perspective, I actually get a ton of my information about what Microsoft's new products are doing through their blogs, from their product managers, and so on. And I think more and more companies, you look at Google, they're blogging about it. So ultimately, it's about embracing the community and sharing information and being more transparent and being open. I think that's just a very good business practice anyways. You should know what your customers are saying and how to improve your product.
There's a really smart guy named Jake McKee. Jake used to be the director of all the community for Lego. And his line is, it's control in a sense via participation and not directive. If you're in the room with somebody else, they're going to be a lot more civil, they're going to be a lot more agreeable than if you're not in the room. The other thing about sort of Second Life and some of the other stuff is, you know, all these companies are sort of rushing to sort of do something in some type of initiative in some of these virtual worlds. And I think it was somebody named Janine Sessom. Janine, raise your hand. Janine, back in the corner, I think she said something like, why are companies like Toyota doing things like building virtual showrooms so people can buy cars? Because you can fly in Second Life, so why the hell would you ever want a car? So it's like, why are you taking, you know, some of these things have been created so you can sort of step out of reality and step out of the traditional world, but you have these traditional companies trying to recreate traditional experiences in these worlds. So then you've got, you know, Darren Berkowitz who creates Get a First Life because it basically just mocks the entire community of go out there and, you know, hug your kid for real instead of hugging this avatar. You know, so it's, I mean, there's no doubt there's value in it. But the other thing, too, is like, you know, ultimately behind every one of these avatars is an individual. So there's a real person out there that has, you know, thoughts and emotions. You may not agree with them, but ultimately you've got to connect with them in some way.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think right now there's a perception of just put a place in a virtual world and they'll come. And I think that's the disconnect that a lot of businesses are having is you don't just create a 3D space and that's how you represent yourself. Again, it goes back to kind of what you were saying in terms of you've got to embrace it. You got to have reasons why people want to go there. I'm not sure, you know, at the end of the day, your first life, you do have a car, so you do want to learn about the car, and that's why you would want to check out the car. But I think ultimately, I'm just going to wrap this up real quick, and then some high-level things I'll just tell you, you know, that I've gotten a lot of interest from. Obviously, business opportunities. Out there, and I just don't think we've actually tapped into what are the real business opportunities. I'm not sure the current environment for virtual worlds is optimized for businesses, but I think we're at the very beginning of this. This is going to be a major shift, and we're just seeing first signs of really early adopters. Within that, though, there is opportunities to really bring business to the business environment. In fact, I had a bunch of people call me up before the RSA security show because that's my background on the security side. They said, man, if there was a way to represent a conference in a virtual space, I'd rather go there and not have to fly across country, you know, pay hotel room and so on. And for the most part, most conferences today used to be about getting new information about products. It's now, you get that on the web, so it's more about connecting with some of the people that are out there, and I think having a virtual environment to do that is important. And ultimately, to enable this, we need standards, and I believe it's not going to be one world for everybody. I think there could be thousands or millions of worlds, just like there's millions of websites out there, and everybody can kind of create their own world, and it could be as small as a single room or as big as, you know, Earth or a galaxy or whatever you want to build into that, and whatever environment and reality that you want to create, you can do that. At a high level, what I've done is really looked at trying to help with Kineva as a company I've started. Kineva stands for Canvas. So we're trying to provide a canvas for really connecting people together and democratizing entertainment. We're really focused on the entertainment piece today. And it's about opening it up so that anybody can connect with others and ultimately grow communities, categorize the content, they can share their experiences, and meet in a 3D world. And one of the key areas, what we've done is, I think is unique, is we've brought in social networking so you can have a profile and your friends and what you're into, what are your hobbies. I think these are important aspects of who you are. Entertainment is anything from, you know, cool videos to music to blogs, and be able to connect to others through entertainment means. And then ultimately, the virtual world is a whole new level of interacting with others. And what we've tried to do from the ground up in our design is to integrate these so that all three elements of this are combined for the first time, so that when I walk up to an avatar in the 3D world, I can right-click on that person and immediately pull up their profile, what are they into, and, you know, just like the real world, in the real world, you don't have that opportunity. If I went up to Jeff today and said, hey, I'd have to ask you a million questions. You know, what kind of movies do you like? What kind of music are you into? And it'd take a while before I connected on lots of different levels. If I could just pull up your profile and go, oh, you like that music as well? You know, I'm into that, and have a common reference point. So for the opportunity to socialize, I think expands much more rapidly and really start to feel like you meet people in these virtual environments. And ultimately, bringing together communities, entertainment in the virtual world into one area, which I think is exciting. I mean, this is going to be a paradigm shift for how people connect, socialize, get their entertainment. But I do think in long term it has a lot of applications for not just fun, but also more serious things around helping blend what's happening in the real world and the virtual world. In fact, one of the things I think is kind of interesting is I'm taking a totally different approach to looking at this. Most video games, you kind of wear a mask in that you're a fighter or a elf. Even Second Life kind of connotes doing something, you know, be somebody that you're not. Be your alternative self that you've always wanted to be. One of the things I'm trying to do in this world, and I don't know anybody who's done this yet, but I really want people in there as themselves, who they are, what they're about, so that when you meet people, it's legitimate. It's really about finding people that share a common interest. And ultimately, this technology, to me, a lot of times people go, well, are you really going to build relationships in there? I think, without a doubt, you're going to build relationships in there, and they're going to be as real, if not more real. Just think about your friendship. How do you judge your friendship? It's based on how, you know, the quality of the time you spend together. Well, in these worlds, if you're spending 17 hours with your group of friends, that's a lot of time and a lot of friendship time that's being built. And ultimately, I think where I see this going is, you know, on your cell phone, when I'm talking to somebody, my mind has disconnected. It doesn't even think about the technology. I'm not thinking that I'm talking to a piece of plastic and metal and it's being transmitted wirelessly. I feel like I'm really talking to my friend, right? And I think the virtual world is going to become like that, where you really are talking to somebody. It's not just an avatar. That is your friend. That is the real person behind that. And I think that's a huge shift in how we view video games and this technology, is that this is as real as the physical world.
Well, not a lot of time, but I'll try and be quick. I'd like to go back to one of your slides. Speaking of that, a lot of examples of what I wanted to comment on, partially addressing some of the questions over there, talking about brand. A lot of previous examples were more corporate focused. I have been in Second Life for the past 2 years, involved with lots of interesting projects. One of the most significant and amazing has been with the American Cancer Society. They've held two Relay for Life, which is Second Life, the virtual walkathon, and fundraiser, and this past year we fundraised $40,000 within this virtual world. With regard to serious games, that's definitely one application. Training, education, the New York Law School is in there, so is the Berkman Center for Engineering Society, which is Harvard Law School. Having virtual classes and exploring as exercise and participation boxes. But the really interesting thing about this case, which is being illustrated by Second Life and some other platforms that I'm alleging, is that we're seeing the emergence of ideas about the 3D web, which is using the virtual world as a front end for web applications. We're starting to see mashups between things on the web, such as Flickr and Facebook. And it's becoming increasingly compelling because when you put things like GPS and geospatially aware devices into the mix, the virtual world starts integrating a bit with real world. Real world becomes your cell phone as these things like Google Earth integrated and virtual. And this is where virtual worlds start becoming disruptive. We will begin to see real applications.
Chris, what's wrong with you coming up to Jeff and asking him what he his interests are and everything. I'm right here.
I'm
sorry.
I'm looking all over.
Here's my concern about this, and the virtual classroom points it up. You know, this hall is going to be a dinosaur one day. This campus is going to be a ghost town. Everything's going to be virtual, and we haven't seen couch potatoes yet. We're going to see, they're going to look like Jabba the Hutt by the time we're done with this virtual world. And socialization, I think, is an oxymoron here. We're being dehumanized to a certain extent. This is a great thing because we're seeing each other. We're seeing our body language. We're seeing facial expressions when we talk to each other. We lose that in this virtual world, and I'm wondering how we prevent that from happening.
Sure. My take on this is the real world and the virtual world are not mutually exclusive. I'll give you an example. When sports was going to be first broadcasted on TV, the sports owners were afraid because if, hey, we put it on TV, no one will go to the game, right? And from that, they actually found the opposite happen. It grew the audience. You know, people who didn't know about the sports, if I couldn't make it to the game, I still kept in touch, so I'm more engaged. And I would, you know, and if I could get the opportunity to come here, I would. And so, you know, 5 years from now, I think there's going to be events like this, without a doubt, in the physical world. The difference will be is we should have a big screen up here for all the people in the audience that are on the internet with their avatars watching what we're doing, asking the same questions, and it's no longer just Atlanta. It could be around the world. So I see it as an amplifier and an extender of what we're doing in the physical world. I mean, sure, some people can stay home and be couch potatoes, and they're doing that today anyways, right? They can watch TV and never leave the home, and that's fine for those that are shy or you know, don't want to meet people. But what happens, though, is they're still meeting people, even more so now. It just happens to be online. And, you know, to the extent that cell phone technology, every time I go somewhere where it's crowded and I got to meet someone, I'm thinking, I can't believe what it would have been like, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago when we didn't have a cell phone, because now I just say, hey, I'm over in this corner, you know, call me, come on over here. And, you know, 20 years ago, I guess you had to do a lot more planning. It's just hard to imagine what it would be like. And so these technologies are empowering us to have more effective lives, connecting with people that I would never have connected with otherwise. So I see it as a big amplifier to being human, as opposed to dehumanizing ourselves.
Got one simple question. Might even be a softball question for you. Throughout your presentation, I've been watching the avatars that you had up in the corner of the slides, which I assume are Kineva avatars. One thing I noticed, none of the avatars were smiling. None of them looked like they were having any fun.
Yeah.
They looked very hip.
Good
They were very well-dressed.
Yeah.
But they didn't look like they were having fun. And I'm wondering, and I've seen this in Second Life, I've seen this in most of the online games, that, you know, the avatars are very static, and they're just there to stand there and kind
right.
of look cool. And I'm wondering, where in the development timeline do you think is genuine emotional expressiveness in online representations, and how important do you think it'll be to long-term widespread adoption?
Right. No, I think that's a great point. If you notice, we're still in beta. That's why they're not as happy as they should be. They're trying to they're helping us find bugs. So they're like, we're waiting. We're having fun, but there's still some improvement. Now, I do think that's where a lot of the innovation is going to come in. I've been following. Ultimately. If this is going to represent who you are, you should have a mood indicator. If I'm happy, if I'm not happy, and it needs to look real. And unfortunately, the technology is at a certain level that it is. I mean, I think ultimately, if you look on the bleeding edge, the graphics there. You know, anybody who's looked at Half-Life, there's a lot of emotion that has been captured into the face. A lot of the really cutting edge games have. I wouldn't say unfortunately, we've made a conscious decision. Ultimately, our graphics, we don't want to be on the extreme bleeding edge, because we want to get computers that have been around for at least 3 or 4 years, and instead of having the latest, greatest graphics card. So we've toned down the graphics a little bit, but over time, I strongly believe that graphics and the emotions and ultimately, not just you as a human in there, but even the what they call NPCs, which is the non-player characters. These are the they're really like robots today, or really dumb robots, because you walk up to them, they don't really move around. You ask them, hey, what's up? And they don't, a lot of times they'll give you a quest, you know, hey, go do this. And it's kind of a mission, kind of part of a storyline, but you don't ever go up there and think, oh, is this real or not real? And ultimately, I think there's a huge amount of innovation to be left there. And we do have laughing in the virtual world as part of one of our animations and smiling and all that. But I think it's definitely going to be it's a great feedback though. So we'll incorporate that. Go ahead.
I had another avatar question. But you made a point about you're going to have avatars.
I thought it might be close enough. I was going to say, it's another avatar question, and it comes back to what you were saying about wanting avatars who were more reflective of what you were like in the real world. And it's not just a question for you, but I'm curious if people in World of Warcraft or Second Life commented too. I find it awkward, you know, going to Second Life. Like, I'm not 20-something years old and buff. You may have noticed that. And I feel awkward, you know, trying to portray that or putting that over. I also think it's weird in Second Life that you can't pick a real name. That's also odd. But, you know, what are your thoughts on making avatars more realistic, and what's everybody's thoughts about how comfortable do you feel in an avatar that doesn't really look like what you look like, for those of us who are not 20 and buff?
Right. Ultimately, this is our first generation of avatars. I also, one of our goals is to make the faces in the bodies more, I guess, adjustable in terms of taking your real face and mapping it to the avatar. So, I mean, what's interesting is if you look at a lot of the profiles where people put up pictures of themselves, I think ultimately it's going to be a preference. Right now, if you don't feel comfortable representing who you are, we've got people who upload their anime picture. We've got some people who upload, you know, maybe the picture of their pet. You know, so we're not going to say you have to do this, but I think the intent of this is to really represent who you are, and if a pet best represents you, that's fine. There's no discrimination against pets, but I think ultimately we do see more and more people uploading real pictures of who they are, and that's actually one of the power of what we're doing is we're tying real photos that you've put up there of who you are, what you're into your avatar. It's not just the 3D character, but it's encompassing all your media. In fact, when I go, what we've done in this world, unlike Second Life where you're paying for property, we give everybody a home. We don't want anybody homeless in this world. And we give them a cheap ability to get, you know, picture frames and a TV. And what's cool is everybody that's in our beta test puts pictures of their friends and families on the wall. And you really start to really get a sense of who they are. And it's been pretty interesting to see how many people do share who they really are. They're not scared to say, hey, I'm human like the rest of us 6 billion people that are out there. And but it is to try and capture that. And I think the technology will evolve to make it much, right now it's hard to model your real self in like Second Life. We're looking at some ways to make it super easy to try and get more like yourself in the world. And I think, you know, right here, this is more marketing and advertising of these avatars. Ultimately, I think you're going to see a large spectrum of who you are in this world. And, it, you know, and to some extent, it does give you some additional freedoms that you may not, you know, there's some applications that are not, that are actually on the health side, we didn't really talk about that, but I actually think there's a lot of health benefits to these virtual worlds. In fact, there's one kid who's living in one of these oxygen bubbles because he doesn't have an immune system, he can't interface, he can't go outside, he doesn't have an option. It's not that he wants to be a couch potato, but he doesn't have an option to go out there and play with friends because, you know, if he ever were to come in contact with germs and stuff, he would have a high chance of dying fairly quickly. So what he's doing though, he's playing World of Warcraft, and he probably doesn't want to represent himself in a bubble. He represents himself as as a character that's on adventures, checking out mountains, fighting dragons and all that. And what's exciting about that was the life expectancy of people in those situations is pretty small. I mean, it's just because for most people, historically, they have been stuck like a couch potato at their house, either looking at the wall or looking at, you know, TV, and you get pretty bored with TV if you spent your whole life watching it. Well, in this case, he's engaged. He's like, I got tons of friends, and he's living a lot longer beyond his expectancy. And I think ultimately, there's a huge connection between the human mind and your emotions and wanting to live, and your health state of your health. And I think if technology can bring some of that reality, whether it's real or not, to you, there's some huge benefits there. In fact, I've talked to some doctors, and they said, yeah, there's without a doubt. Like I was talking to a doctor, he said, if you get called, if a patient, you know, doesn't have friends or family, and they go home after surgery, if a doctor or a nurse calls that person and says, hey, you know, we're thinking about you, you're in our prayers, we really want you to do well, their chance of survival goes up immediately 20%.
Okay.
And that's pretty powerful. And if the virtual world can connect you to friends that you might not have otherwise, that's a pretty powerful thing.
Chris, we're going to take one more question, and then I think we're going to break, but will you be sticking around to talk to people more?
Sure. Absolutely.
Just wanted to speak up for letting people pick their own avatars. And going back to the comment about dehumanizing, I actually, considering that I've been doing this, some of these 3D worlds ever since some of the first VRML-based applications came out, the way I look at it is actually giving me the freedom to be able to redefine what human needs to meet and to everyone else within the 3D world. And especially when you get into things like cosplay and some of the other areas where people are taking the avatar they have in their 3D world or their favorite characters, and they start modifying their real world existence around the way they would prefer their life to be, that they develop within the game arena or within the 3D world. It's not dehumanizing so much as it's allowing people the freedom. Right now, we do not have the scientific capability of biologically changing our appearance and our entire, you know, basic DNA structure so that we could be a troll for this. But within, you know, probably the next 50 to 100 years, that may be a capability. And I think what you're seeing is people starting to explore redefining humanity and their entire biological structure within these worlds and starting to try and pull that out of the 3D world into reality itself. So I think you're going to see the emerging of the two rather than the being of the other.
I would agree with that, meaning that I think the lines are going to blur as technology is advancing. You're already seeing today where certain, if you've lost an arm, there's, you know, you can get artificial limbs for your leg and for your arms. Hearing, I know there's been some pretty big breakthroughs on hearing where you now can start, some people who've not been able to hear for like 20 years plop in a device and now they're able to hear. Obviously, even the hearing aid, does that dehumanize you? I think no, it makes you more human. You're able to connect better, listen to others. And in fact, you know, if you really think about it, and this is a thing that I think about, is how does Atlanta compete on a global basis? Or how does any business compete? More and more, if you're not thinking about how to connect with people leveraging technology, you're not going to connect to the right people. You're going to be limited to the resources. And you can't be limited to resources geographically, because those that are going to, you know, compete more effectively are going to tap into the best minds wherever they're at in the world. And I know, you know, a lot of companies are working with their different departments around the world. And, you know, I never thought of it as dehumanizing if I have a conference call with somebody. In fact, we're all treating each other as humans and working together and collaborating together. So I think ultimately, you know, whether it's that business where you're connecting, you know, at the end of the day, it's about how you treat others. If you treat them with respect and understanding, it doesn't matter how you do the technology. It's just a tool at the end of the day. It's an enabler. and that we're all humans, and part of why we're here is, let's talk about how is this technology enabling us to do new things, whether, you know, in 20 years you can change your DNA and next thing you know you're running around like an elf. Some people will do it. You know, you could, you know, you go to some of these conferences like Dragon Con and others, there's, you know, there's definitely people out there who would do it yesterday if they could. And, you know, from that, I think we're going to see a lot of innovation in this area. I think there's a lot of people who want to hit the restroom, maybe.
Yes, restrooms, lunch is about to be available. Also, I want to make sure you grab the schedule. If you signed up on the wall, this is your schedule. Otherwise, go sign up, pick your schedule. But definitely want to thank Chris Klaus for showing up with us today.
Thanks, Carrie.
Interested in podcasting? Want to mingle with other podcasters or learn how to get started yourself? Then mark your calendar for PodCamp Atlanta, happening March 16th through 18th at Emory University. For more information and to add yourself to the registration list, visit podcampatlanta.com. And by the way, it's free.
The song you heard in this podcast was Garden by Cargo Cult, available only on magnatune.com. Thanks for listening to UnConcast on the Georgia Podcast Network. If you have recorded or are planning to record a discussion that you think would make a good episode of UnConcast, email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com to learn how you can submit it.